Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
It's a pleasure to welcome Zachary Lazar to the Tattered Cover with his new book, Evening's Empire. After growing up in Colorado, Zachary graduated from Brown University in 1990. Today, he is adjunct professor at Hofstra University in Long Island. He published his first novel, Aaron, approximately in 1998. Not approximately 98, but that was the title. And his second, Sway, was named a New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice, a Rolling Stone recognition as one of the best books of 2008, and a Publisher's Weekly Best Book of 2008. The book is being translated, I think, as we speak, into three languages. He also received the James Michener Copernicus Society Prize for Iowa's Writers' Workshop and has held fellowships in the Fine Arts Center at Provincetown. In 1975, when he was just 6 years old, his father, Edward, was shot by hitmen in Phoenix, Arizona, parking garage. Evening's Empire, folks have said, in Evening's Empire, Lazar brilliantly attempts to reconstruct the sequence of events that led to his father's murder. So let's welcome him this evening and hear about his new book.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks for coming out on this awful night. I mean, this weather is terrible. I guess I'll read for a little bit, and then if people have some questions, they can ask. I'll just read from the first part of the book. So it doesn't really require much introduction. Except today, that it said after the first sentence, there's a long quote from a newspaper article. And that language is not my language. When it switches to my language, I'll let you know. So this is just the start of the book. In the fall of 1996, a few days after my wedding, an article about my father appeared in the Arizona Republic, an updating of the old unhappy story. This is the article. The men from Chicago were efficient. In the shadowy stairwell of the parking garage on North Central Avenue, they placed four .22 caliber shots into the chest of accountant Ed Lazar and one into the back of his head. They then partially unscrewed a light bulb near the door and disabled a fluorescent fixture, throwing the area into total darkness. It was hours before police found the body February 19, 1975. It was two decades before they found out who killed Lazar and why. On Tuesday, they revealed the truth, along with information about a string of murders in Phoenix that they know or suspect was carried out by Chicago mob killers. That information, among other things, throws new light on the murder of Arizona Republic reporter Don Bowles in 1976. Phoenix police said that Ned Warren Sr., then the king of Arizona land fraud, ordered the hit on Lazar, his bookkeeper and business partner. They said John Harvey Adamson, the chief assassin in the Bowles killing, finally told police a year ago that Warren had ordered the hit on Lazar. Adams did not take part in the contract on Lazar, police said. The killers who did take the contract, two Chicago Mafia hitmen, murdered Lazar the day before he was to testify in front of a Maricopa County grand jury about Warren's bogus real estate deals, in which millions of dollars were swindled from thousands of investors. He was going to name Ned Warren as the godfather of land fraud in Arizona, said Sergeant Mike Torres, a Phoenix police spokesman. Ned Warren was a natural suspect, but there was no one to give him up. Warren was eventually convicted of fraud and bribery and died in prison in 1980. Ned Warren went to Adamson and asked him to kill three people: Lazar, Arizona Real Estate Commissioner J. Fred Talley, and a third person whose name he could not remember, Torres said. Talley, who said he issued real estate licenses to convicted felons, was suspended amid an investigation into whether he helped Warren in his activities. Talley later retired and died of a heart attack. The new information about the Lazar killing and the plan to kill Talley recalls a lurid period in Arizona's history, the late 1960s and 1970s, when land fraud artists roamed the state in sharp suits, gouging money from buyers and investors across the country and the world. That was from the Arizona Republic, October 2nd, 1996. This is now me. 90 miles north of Phoenix in Yavapai County, Arizona, is a large subdivision of mobile homes and small single-story houses called Verde Lakes. The land once belonged to a sprawling ranch, dating back to the late 19th century, when the nearby town of Camp Verde had been established to fend off raids from the Yavapai and Apache tribes that had lived for generations in that region. In the summer of 1969, the summer of the moon landing, my father, Edward Lazar, and his business partner, Ned Warren Sr., financed a down payment on this land with a loan from a London-born entrepreneur named David Rich. They paid this money into a trust, and the company they formed, Consolidated Mortgage Corporation, hired crews to remake the ranch house into a clubhouse, to excavate a small lake where there had been none, to bring in breeding pairs of ducks, and to plant 3-inch-high sapling trees. They did not build houses on the land, nor did they intend to. Verde Lakes existed as a possibility. As a fact, it was empty desert divided on a map into quarter-acre lots. The plan was to retail hundreds of these lots to small-scale investors, many of them nearing retirement, who would build their own homes there or resell the land once its value rose. The company hired Cesar Romero, the actor most famous for playing the Joker on TV's Batman, as a public relations spokesman. They installed roads and utilities and water lines for homes that did not yet exist. They did all of this on credit, soliciting capital from banks, corporations, and private investors throughout the country, using as collateral and sometimes selling as securities the mortgages on the lots sold by the company's salesmen. For a brief while, my father was a paper millionaire. For a much longer time, he was in financial crisis. At one point, he and his partner Warren were personally $2 million in debt. When my father got out of the land business in 1973, he had nothing to show for his 4 years of struggle. I was 5 years old then. He was a devoted father, according to everyone I've talked to, though I have almost no memories of him that I can feel certain are true and not the kind suggested by photographs. On the CBS Evening News of February 21, 1975, Walter Cronkite appeared seated before a map of Arizona to deliver a story about my father and his business partner, Ned Warren Sr. Thousands of investors, many among those who could least afford it, have bought Arizona's land worth far less than they paid for it, Cronkite read. The multi-million-dollar fraud is under investigation. But now there's a startling new development, a gangland-style murder. Cronkite looked down at his cue card before reading the last phrase, as if the word gangland, pronounced by Cronkite as gangland, could not be said without a slight pause to distance himself from its tabloid crudeness. There was a shot of a stretcher being rolled toward an ambulance that to our eyes now looks like a large station wagon or a hearse. The body on the stretcher, covered with a blanket from foot to head, was identified by the on-scene reporter in the clipped style of a newsreel. The victim, Edward Lazar, found in a Phoenix garage Wednesday with 5 bullets in his body. The 2 homicide detectives in their sport coats collapsed the stretcher and pushed it into the ambulance. There was an image now of a press photo of my father's face. The cameraman had positioned the photo on a bed of fabric so that with this border the picture could fit the dimensions of a TV screen. It was black and white. All of this footage was in black and white. When you watch it now, it has the unreal quality of a crime movie trying to capture a period. My father looked eager and shrewd in the photograph. He was still in his early 30s when it was taken. His eyes penetrated the frame as if he could easily and accurately read the gaze of whoever might be looking back at him. His dark hair was short, and his lips were parted, not in a smile, but as if to say something precise and illuminating in the midst of a dispute. The reporter continued, Lazar was scheduled to appear yesterday before a grand jury investigating sales of virtually worthless land for as much as $400 million. Lazar's testimony was expected to focus on his one-time business associate, Ned Warren Sr., a mysterious figure widely known in Arizona as the Godfather of Land Fraud. That phrase, the Godfather of Land Fraud, had bedeviled my father for at least 5 months before his death, since Warren's first indictment. It had started as a joke 2 or 3 years before someone had given Warren a birthday present of director's chairs printed with the words of the Godfather on the backs. But now the joke had become an epithet in dozens of newspaper stories written about Warren, often containing a reference to his prison record, his land swindles, and most recently the payments that he, along with my father and other associates, had made to government officials. The word Godfather now chimed with the word gangland to produce mafia. On screen, the handsome 60-year-old Warren moved slowly and confidently down a courthouse hallway, trailed by reporters and cameramen. He was faintly smiling, well-dressed in a conservative gray suit, his hands either crossed in front of his waist or in the pockets of his pants. He looked as if the extent of his secrets was faintly comic to him, as if no one would ever suspect half the things he knew, or as if most of what he had done would be impossible to prove. He seemed to know all of this as he walked the courthouse hallway, and he wasn't wrong. I have an essay my father wrote when he was 12 years old, a schoolboy's essay about the Hebrew poet Chaim Bialik. In 1946, the essay won first prize, choice of $25 U.S. savings bond or a week at Herzl Camp, in an annual contest held by the Minneapolis Zionist Youth Commission. This is a quote from his essay. Bialik's popularity should not only be attributed to his poetic genius, but also to his personality in general, to his brilliancy of thought, and to his responsiveness to the needs of his people. As long as there lives a Jew who still delights in beauty, imagery, and poetry, so long will the immortal words of Chaim Nachman Bialik be found on the lips, in the minds, and in the hearts of Israel. When I first discovered this essay, I saw in it evidence of a straight-A student, earnest, eager to please. When I looked at it a little longer, I saw evidence of a boy smart enough to conceal a total lack of interest in the poems of Chaim Bialik beneath the lilting arrangement of phrases on the lips, in the minds, and in the hearts of Israel. I don't know how to connect the fact that my father saved this essay and prize citation with the fact that he was murdered in a garage. His story refutes an idea I seem still incapable of outgrowing, the idea that who we are plays some part in shaping our lives, or as Heraclitus put it, that character is fate. 5 bullets, one in the back of my father's head, 4 in his chest. At 9 o'clock in the morning on February 19th, my father, arriving at work in an office building on Phoenix's North Central Avenue, was met by 2 hitmen from Chicago, Lee DeFranco and Robert Hardin, who forced him into a stairwell and shot him 5 times with a .22 semi-automatic pistol fitted with a homemade silencer, probably a Coke bottle. They left the shell casings on the ground but unscrewed the, the fluorescent light in the stairwell to prevent anyone from discovering too soon what they'd done. After taking whatever cash had been in my father's money clip, DeFranco, according to Hardin's account, placed a dime on my father's forehead. They left behind his car keys and credit cards, and they left his briefcase on the ground outside the open door of his Pontiac Granville. They were paid $10,000 for this, and neither of them ever went to jail. Ned Warren didn't speak on the CBS Evening News of February 21st. He was not available to newsmen, the reporter said. Instead, the next person to speak was Attorney General Bruce Babbitt, future candidate for president, future Secretary of the Interior, at that moment riding the land fraud scandals in Arizona toward the state's governorship. In 1975, Babbitt was gangly and wore glasses, and he hunched forward in his chair like a graduate student in a seminar room. As a prosecutor, he said, clearing his throat, "I'm not about to speculate publicly about who murdered Ed Lazar. But when a man with Lazar's knowledge and background is murdered on his way to the grand jury, in the style in which he was murdered, it would be very coincidental to attribute it to some extraneous reason that is not related to those facts." The last man to speak put it more bluntly. He was another of Warren's former business associates, a man named James Cornwall. Cornwall was tall and slightly jowly, with the sideburns and pomaded hair of the revivalist preacher Billy Graham, appropriate since Cornwall had just become a minister himself. His suit and tie were of an expensive-looking subtle plaid, and he sat with one hand across his knee to reveal an elegant wristwatch. He seemed at ease, despite the fact that he was facing 66 counts of fraud, 40 years in prison. "Mr. Warren has told me he had the ability to pick up the phone and have people maimed or killed," Cornwall said. "I believed it at the time, and I believe it now." On the afternoon before this story appeared on the CBS Evening News, more than 400 people had attended my father's memorial service at the Sinai Mortuary Chapel, which did not have enough seats for such a large crowd. There were my parents' friends, the Courts and the Goodmans, the Feinbergs and the Stars, the Kobes and the Shares, young Jewish couples, their children in school for the day. There were our next-door neighbors, Carol and Dick Nichols, who had taken me the night before with their sons, David and Craig, to a soapbox derby and spaghetti dinner to give me some time away from the confusion of adults crowding our house. There were the members of the Jewish Community Center, where my parents played tennis, and of Temple Beth Israel, where my sister Stacy and I went to the annual Purim carnivals dressed in costumes my mother made out of towels, construction paper, and glitter. There were my grandparents on both sides, my aunts and uncles. There were the associates of Gallant Pharaoh and of Laventhal, Krekstein, Horvath, and Horvath, the accounting firms my father had worked for before and after his stint in the land business. David Rich, the London-born entrepreneur, was there. Ned Warren, though he had befriended my parents socially in the 4 years my father was his business partner, was not there. None of it made any sense to the people in the memorial service. The story of hitmen in a stairwell, Ned Warren picking up a phone and ordering them there. It was something out of a movie, not even a realistic movie. There was the grief over the young man they'd all had a special liking for, and then there was the sense that his death would never seem real, that the sudden violence was so incongruous with his personality that the two could not be held in the mind at the same time. They thought about my father's sly smile, the way he sometimes seemed to look at everybody from an amused distance, and then they thought about the front page photo of his body slumped in a stairwell. The banner headline, "Grand Jury Witness in Probe of Warren is Slain Gang Style." His friends were in the furniture business or in real estate, practiced law or accounting or engineering. Their wives played mahjong and tennis and golf. Like my father, the men rooted for the ASU football team, took their families on vacation to Lake Havasu or San Diego. My father could be quiet. There was something he held in reserve, a mystery about him, even a romance. But there wasn't crookedness, there wasn't criminality. He was not your average CPA. Women liked him. He had an adventurous side. He liked to drink. This adventurous side may have been why he got into a risky business like land development in the first place. But no one at the memorial service imagined he had ties to the underworld, or even knowledge of enough wrongdoing to be murdered. No one thought that. In the parking lot outside, a reporter named Al Sitter from the Arizona Republic was taking down license plate numbers to see if any of them corresponded to figures of organized crime. The shame, added to the grief, was now beginning. Before long, my father would be appearing in news stories as the lieutenant to Ned Warren's godfather. the one man now dead who had intimate knowledge of the full extent of Warren's criminality. Eventually, my father would come to look like a con man with a flashy suit and a Cadillac, or even a full-blown mobster, perhaps a relative of the Jewish gangster Jaime Lazar, as one line of thought ran. He was murdered twice in this way. I remember his forehead being broad, with lines scored across it, lines that even then I thought I would inherit, and by doing so know I was an adult. I used to try on his boots, stumbling toward the fireplace with its mesh screen pulled closed by a thin chain. I remember the family room's white shag rug, its console stereo with a plastic arm on which you could stack several records at once. I remember an avocado linoleum floor in the kitchen, a passway that looked into the living room, dark in memory, small and long. The living room, the family room, the kitchen. I remember the rooms. Whatever I write here about my father himself will have to be a kind of conjuration. I have always had two ideas, that one day I would have to write about my father's story, and that if I ever did so, I'd never be able to write another thing again. What story could compare with his? The question was a more specific case of a larger dilemma. What could I ever do that would not seem trivial compared to what he went through? It took me 10 years to start. In the 10 years I waited, some people who might have told me things died. When I at last flew to Phoenix a week before Christmas 2006, I wasn't thinking very much about what I was doing. I had put the trip together in such a hasty way that I had no time to consider my expectations. The pilot announced we were beginning our descent towards Sky Harbor Airport, and I was there. I had a stack of newspaper clippings, a few relevant books, the addresses of the people and places I was going to visit. I had appointments and dinners set up for every night I would be there. I would wake up at 6:30 every morning and go to bed at midnight, and every moment of that time I would be following a schedule, not thinking about it. He was not a big talker. This was something I learned from my interviews over the phone with some of my father's friends. He could keep a secret, one of them said, as you know. My father's one-time roommate, Barry Starr, had lived in the same apartment with him for 3 years and still felt he never knew him, that he remained a mystery. Phone calls would sometimes come to the apartment from a woman named Ruth, a woman who was otherwise a total secret. Only years later did Barry Starr learn that Ruth was Ed's ex-wife, that they had a son together named Richard. The story is not in one anecdote or newspaper article, but in 200 anecdotes and newspaper articles. The story is in the relationship between 8,000 facts that for weeks and months seem to have no relationship at all. A young accountant takes a chance. He goes into business with a man who has a not very savory reputation, a man who in fact has a criminal record. No one knows exactly why he does this. This is the first mystery. It has something to do with his having a secretive side. He could almost lead two lives, according to one friend. It has something to do with his being adventurous, with his not being your average CPA. A kind of conjuration. You look at the facts and see an intricate puzzle with some pieces missing. You establish a timeline. You think of possible motives of psychology. You piece together what you know and imagine how things could have played out in rooms 40 years ago, most of the players long since dead. Anyway, that's the end of the prologue, and that's where I'll stop for now. Thanks. So as you can see, it's kind of a feel-good book for the holiday season. Thanks again, everybody.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Foden. We have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.